Revenue Committee, this is usually the call to bring members down as the pounding of the gavel. The order that we will go today is first Senate Bill 858, and we'll have Senator Winters present that to us, and then we'll go with Senate JR Resolution 28 following that. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 858 and welcome our senator for this area, Jackie Winters.
Thank you, Chair Deckard, and I thank you for hearing Senate Bill 858 actually is a bill that was requested by SUMCO. SUMCO has two actual plants in Salem. One is their North plant, which is in Senator Courtney's district, and the other one is in South Salem, which is in my district. You know, I don't have to tell you about the economic climate in Oregon and the severity that we're not only facing with our budgets inside of state government, but also that's occurring with the companies that reside in Oregon. And this bill is to get us through our difficult times and to assure that we continue employment. SUMCO was granted an enterprise zone status in 2000, and with the enterprise zone status, there's a corresponding tax exemption that occurs. What they would like to do is to be able to renegotiate with their sponsor, which in this case is the city of Salem, so that they can continue operating in Salem. I won't go into a lot of specific details because you do have the experts that are here, and I understand they're in the back, but I would ask that you give it favorable consideration. It's legislation that will assist us in Salem to keep the employees that we have there. We don't want to lose the plant, and we don't want to further erode our employment base. So I do thank you for hearing this, and if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Questions for Senator Winters? Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy your committee. Mr. Fish, do you want to give us some context, and then we'll have the sponsors of the bill up following Mr. Fish from our Economic and Community Development Department. Have we added anything to that yet?
Chair Deckard, members of the Senate Revenue Committee, nice to be here again. And as far as the name, I'm not sure if we've added anything, but there is, I believe, thoughts of subtracting. So, we're quite happy, you know, to call it what you want. Well, maybe not. But for the record, my name is Arthur Fish, and I am the Enterprise Zone Coordinator. And in contrast to yesterday's hearing, I just want to, specify here we're talking about the shorter term exemption on property in an enterprise zone. It lasts generally for just 3 years, but can be extended to 4 or 5 years. And it's shorter term, but it's much more long-standing. It began in 1985. The current laws that really apply here were more or less set in 1989-1991. And the main requirement that really a business just to get the 3 years has to satisfy is, in essence, that they increase their employment by one person or 10%, whichever is greater. This 110% mark is based on the existing employment when they pre-certify before they begin a project. And my understanding of why that's done is that, you know, there's nothing magic about 10% so much as it's a test of significance, so that the exemption is not available, for better or worse, to existing companies that are just doing business as usual. There is one exception by which the local governments for very large investments can waive ahead of time when the company pre-certifies this 110% requirement. And so that's the way it's been, like I say, about 12, 14 years. The situation, however, recently with SUMCO and a few other companies, and there's usually a company or two every year or so that is disqualified because of inadequate employment or they don't start an exemption. in some of those cases, I understand, and I may be corrected on some of these figures, but over the last 2 or 3 years, and I should point out, they invested hundreds of millions of dollars over several years in the 1990s. Their employment then was several hundred people. They've increased it and are well above that. They're just finishing up the last parts of those exemptions on some of that, on some of the last bits of property that they invested then. And that exemption is in no way applicable here. They've got more than enough people for that. But in 2000, they pre-certified and have since invested, I believe, something on the order of about $50 million in new equipment. When they pre-certified, their jobs were about 1,037 people, I think. And they, and my understanding is that they got up above the necessary 1,141 at one point. So they were able to start their exemption by meeting the initial requirement. But as far as the average annual employment that they must maintain during each of the 3 years, they were in 2001 down to 1,080. Reportedly, and that's not sufficient, as we know, and that's the issue. And then I think the current numbers are you know, a couple, even a little less than that. And you know, I assume once they get to full speed, they might recover, but it might be after this exemption is well over. I should point out one last thing that I've noticed about the 10% requirement. While for a lot of existing businesses, especially smaller ones, it's not terribly difficult, so to speak. Like I say, it's just a test of significance. Some companies add a lot more jobs, some only just the bare minimum. But the larger a company gets and the larger its existing workforce, the harder that 10% is. And in lieu of, you know, not every company is immediately disqualified for the whole exemption, including back taxes, if they miss it for just 1 year. We do have a little way to sort of allow them that was added a couple of years ago so that 1 year's fluctuation only cost them 1 year's tax savings. But the reality is that the larger your workforce, the harder or more significant that 10% becomes. And that's all I think I need to provide here for you.
Art, have you seen the -1 amendments?
Yes. And I think they are useful and necessary for what I understand to be the situation.
And do they narrow it down to SUMCO, or are there other?
It's pretty narrow to begin with, but it does narrow it down to the extent that it would work for the SUMCO situation. How many other situations it would have worked for or not, I'm not sure. The main issue there is the size of the investment. The current prospective waiver that the sponsor can offer is only available once somebody has invested $25 million or more. Huge project. This would set it at $20 million for that first year's group. Still not something, you know, I've not heard of any other big companies that have invested that kind of thing. There's only a handful statewide that are in a similar situation.
Appreciate your time.
Enjoy yourself.
You're free.
Thank you.
If you want to be.
What?
You're free if you want to be.
I'll be in the room.
Enjoy yourself, Mr. Chair.
We have had Mr. Fish for, and he's been in House Revenue also. So, Mr. Benton and Betsy Earls. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls. I am a member of the law firm Harang Long Gary Rudnick, and I am here today representing our client SUMCO Oregon and Jack Benton. We are talking with you today about Senate Bill 858, which is a bill that has been brought by Senator Winters on behalf of SUMCO. And I think you'll find in your packet, if you haven't looked already, the -1 amendments, which are actually a fairly integral part of the bill that you're considering today. I think Jack will go through, for the most part, what they do. But one thing you want to understand before we go forward is that these amendments do take out the section in the bill that would offer any refund or penalties that have already been paid. That's not something that we had intended to do. I think the other point I want to make before Mr. Benton starts is that this bill applies to mainly SUMCO, but just so that you all understand, only to urban enterprise zones, not to rural. That seems to be a different kettle of fish from what I understand. So that's where we are, and I'll turn it over to Jack.
The Chair and members of the Senate Revenue Committee, I appreciate the time that you allowed me to speak, and I thank Betsy for her kind words. I provided you with a brief handout. I'm going to take you rapidly through some numbers and talk a little bit about the technical elements of the request that we're making. Excuse me. And my name is Jack Benton. I'm Vice President, General Affairs of SUMCO USA Corporation. General Affairs is an interesting term. To explain it, it's I do everything that nobody else wants to do.
Not we kind of feel that way.
Welcome to the Oregon Legislature.
Let me talk about Senate Bill 858 briefly. It is a technical revision. It's not massive, and it is very narrow. And as a matter of principle, we've kept it that way, but obviously we're sensitive to the broader need in the community if, in fact, it needs to be adjusted further. I've handed you a handout that talks a little bit about SUMCO Oregon Corporation, and we have to bear with me as I go through SUMCO Oregon Corporation because it's the essence of Senate Bill 858. In the first page, the chronological growth of SUMCO Oregon is we came to Oregon in 1982. This was a California corporation that had started its business in Menlo Park as a test silicon wafer manufacturer. Silicon wafers is the base material used by the semiconductor industry in making computer chips or semiconductor components. We've added significant amount of investment from that period of time. If the initial facility was in North Salem, we've added additional buildings there that do specialized activities. And in 1995, we started construction on a south campus in South Salem near the airport in the Fairview Industrial Complex. The investments that we've made during this period of time are close to $750 million. So it's been a significant amount of investment. The in year 2000, we increased the capacity of our South Campus facility and made a significant investment in 2000 and 2001, and we applied for Enterprise Zone status in the year 2000. In 2002, there was a merger between the silicon operations of Mitsubishi Materials Corporation and Sumitomo Metals Corporation, resulting in a new entity called SUMCO. SUMCO is Sumitomo Mitsubishi Silicon Corporation, and it's a global silicon wafer manufacturing with about 25% of the world's market. If we look at the next two pages of your handout, you'll get a visual picture of our North and South Campus facilities. The important topic that I want to talk about is actually this slide, the presentation on the sales revenue. This is the crux of the matter in terms of what's happened to the silicon wafer industry. In the fourth quarter of 2000, was the peak of the silicon wafer manufacturing market, and from that period of time, there's been a significant decline in the semiconductor industry of a catastrophic proportion and one that's lasted longer than any period of time in history. And even though there's been a small recovery, it has not reached the levels again of 2000, and we don't expect that to come back until at best at the end of this year and more probably in the year 2004. And during this period of time, the company has experienced significant losses. For the last 4 years, our losses have exceeded $250 million. The resultant effect is that there's significant pressure on the company to manage its costs, and the only variable costs that we can deal with are things like the labor force. And the next slide talks about our headcount and gives you a visual picture of the history of the company since 1990 in terms of its headcount, average headcount per year. When we established the Enterprise Zone in 2000, we were obligated to maintain a workforce of 1,140 as part of that Enterprise Zone certification process. And the market decreased immediately after we were certified. And from that period of time, we've had a decrease in headcount to the point now we're at a level below 800 people in Salem. The important point here is that this industry is built around capacity, and there's significant overcapacity in the market today. The only way that this industry is going to survive is to eliminate capacity. And with this juncture, the company's globally looking at its various operations to determine where capacity can be taken out of the marketplace. And this is done based on where is the least efficient activities occurring. And this is a serious thought process and business decision, and it may well affect our ability to continue to do business in Oregon, and more particularly to the city of Salem. So at this point, we're at a point where we're looking at trying to maintain and keep as low a cost operation as we possibly can in Oregon in order to sustain our investment here. This is important for two reasons. One is the long-term job creation, which is extremely important and why the Enterprise Zone statute exists. But more importantly, it, in our case, is the amount of capital investment we have here. Our capital investment is in equipment, which can be easily moved. And one of the fears that we would have would be that if we become uncompetitive in Oregon, is that we would move the equipment or sell the equipment, which then it would come off the tax rolls. So we have a double hit problem potentially, in that we not only lose jobs, but we lose tax assessed valuation. And we're a significant taxpayer today to the city of Salem. As Mr. Fish pointed out, we are no longer subjected to any Enterprise Zone status except for this small investment, or in our terms small, that we made in 2000 and 2001. So we're today expecting to pay about $4.5 million in property taxes to the city of Salem for the year 2003. And that's without consideration for the Enterprise Zone situation that we have in front of you. So the essence of Senate Bill 858 is essentially to allow the sponsor of the Enterprise Zone to have flexibility during the Enterprise Zone period to compensate for economic declines, to allow relief for those types of entities that make large investments which result in long-term property tax payments. We have asked that the investment criteria be lowered. In our case, actually, that lowered amount doesn't apply, but we asked that it have it be lowered. And that although we have asked for a very narrow window, and that is for those entities that were approved for enterprise zone status in the year 2000, that's something that certainly we would be willing to look more favorably on if it was opened up. So that's the essence of Senate Bill 858. Thank you.
Is there no mechanism available now to appeal the conditions that a company would be placed under in one of these agreements in terms of the number of jobs they'd have to supply? Or
No, there's not. As Mr. Fish pointed out earlier, the only time that we have is it's a one-time election. At the time that we applied for certification for enterprise zone status, had we applied for relief of the headcount at that point in time for investments over $25 million, the sponsor would have had to have had flexibility to waive or to reduce or moderate. That election that we did not take, we believed our own forecasts, unfortunately. Beyond that, the sponsor has no flexibility. And one which I would encourage as we move the enterprise zone status, I think that the sponsor should have some flexibility to deal with these types of economic cycles that we go through.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Your
presentation was great. Jim Craven, Patrick Green.
Together again.
Would you prefer to be separate?
Mr. Chair, we're not allowed to be photographed together. So,
when I think of one, I think of
it's
the
kind
two
of
together.
Not to confuse the committee. Ongoing joke with House Revenue. Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Jim Craven, for the record, American Electronics Association. SUMCO is a member of AEA, and we've been following this legislation, and we support it. I think it is a fairly narrowly drawn bill. I believe it has the support of the sponsoring agency, in this case, the City of Salem. They can speak for themselves, but it's a local window for this significant employer in this town to work with its local government to hopefully preserve those jobs in this town and preserve that base of multi-millions of dollars of property taxes that the company does pay, and to try to get through this hopefully narrowing window of economic downturn and turn things around so that investment can be maintained here in Salem and continue to provide the jobs that it does. So we support the bill, and I think there's others that can give you more additional technical information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just one quick question. When the original Enterprise Zone bill, why was the flexibility not granted within it? Do you know back when we first enacted why we put the tough constrictions on that you'd have to come back to the legislature for us to grant the authority for the sponsoring agency then to open it up again?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. If Mr. Fish is still behind me, he may know the answer to that. But I don't believe I was involved in the original enactment of enterprise zone legislation, so I don't have any history on that. Uh-huh. Sorry.
Mr. Fish is just giving a blank stare looking for... Thank you. Patrick.
Thank you. I'll be brief on this bill. For the record, my name is Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Oregon Revenue Coalition, and I'm testifying in neutrality of this bill. I just want to raise a couple of quick concerns. Very sympathetic to SUMCO and other employers like them who are hit hard in the recession. We have lots of members who are unemployed as a result of the economy, and so we're very sympathetic. We like the new amendments that were added and the narrow scope of the bill. to begin with, and are sympathetic to both SUMCO and the City of Salem for trying to preserve these jobs. The concern comes with a couple things. One is that we do know that the property tax can be hard on businesses, particularly when they're in tough times, because you pay it whether or not you're profitable or not. And as SUMCO said, they're on the hook for about $4.5 million, which is not chump change. But we also do need job creation, don't want to make it easy for people to get off the hook. And I think that that's where, and I'm not speaking specifically of SUMCO, but just in general of going down the road of making it easier for people to break the agreement, or, and I wouldn't even characterize this particular bill as that, but make it easier for people to sort of negotiate out of it once they're already there, the community's already relying on them, the community, you know, they've committed to create a number of jobs, and then, you know, sort of putting communities on the hook and saying, well, you know, we said we would come up with 2,000 jobs, but it looks like it's going to be, you know, more on the order of 200, and we'd like to negotiate with you on that, and if not, we're leaving, right? I mean, it's just... So I think that we think that it needs to be hard to get an exemption or waiver, or that you look to what's currently in statute in terms of waiver. There's a waiver process for first source hiring agreement necessary for the exemption. There's waiver rules where it's ORS 285B 0.723. Which has a waiver process for first source hiring agreements, and it goes to the Economic and Community Development Office. And if the director sees that the business firm is unable to employ persons referred under the agreement for first source hiring agreements, or the waiver will further the goals and purposes of applicable state policies, then they can, you know, the director can sort of can grant the waiver. And that's the extent of my knowledge about how the waiver process works. But it seems to me that there's sort of the state kind of can insert itself in and just kind of guard against maybe communities being held hostage. I don't think that that's happening here, but, you know, were you to amend this bill, you know, next session or something to, you know, take off the narrow scope of the dates, you could have all sorts of problems. And I think the state does have an interest to make sure that communities, you know, smaller communities are being protected. So with that, I'll answer any questions. But that's, we're neutral, just have some concerns.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Sure, Hannon.
Your revenue coalition yesterday issued a statement to our committee on some other issues, concern about tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
Tax stipulations that other businesses and people enjoy and benefit from. The first one out of the box today, after your statement was issued yesterday, you're neutral on. Are you rescinding your statement from yesterday on tax credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I wouldn't say that we're necessarily rescinding what we said before. I haven't seen what the fiscal is on, and I mean, normally, if it's significant fiscal impact to the state, we would be in opposition. But I haven't seen the revenue impact, so I didn't feel like it was appropriate for us to come and just flat out oppose the bill without knowing what the revenue impact was.
Well, that makes two of us, because I don't see a fiscal statement attached either, and the revenue statement doesn't indicate what the dollar amount is, and it was based upon the original bill, and now we have an amendment here that narrows it down, and it still doesn't identify what the amount is. Is there going to be a recommendation on the dollar amount, Mr. Chairman, and are we going to see that fiscal impact to not only the state and the City of Salem?
I'll take a crack at that. We'll hold the, we probably won't move the bill today, but the fiscal for the state, because this is a property tax, and so we're mainly dealing with the City of Salem, the sponsoring entity who's going to testify next, and any decision that they would make. I think they might be able to inform us of any fiscal impact that they will feel as a city, but my view of it is that's an issue between this company and the City of Salem.
Do they take a deduction, Mr. Chairman, on their income tax or corporate income tax on the property tax offset that is provided?
I'm getting a no.
further.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
The chair and the members of the committee, as I indicated earlier, first of all, the accumulated losses that the company has incurred and that there has been no income taxes paid since the inception of the company. But in fact, the deduction for the property tax paid was a deduction on the tax return. But again, there was no income taxes paid.
So what you're saying is you haven't paid any income tax since you've been here?
We've never made any money since we've been here, sir.
But you're still being allowed to take a tax credit against future income that you don't make any profit on, right?
That's correct, sir.
So 0-0 is still zero.
That's the math.
All right. Thanks.
One other question, and maybe Economic Development Department knows the answer. If you do, come on up. The question is, Patrick in his testimony indicated that there might be a procedure in place for the director of OEDD to deal with circumstances like this. I don't know if SUMCO is aware of that, or if that, in fact, under the ORS that he cited, actually exists where the director can do that.
Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Fish.
Again, for the record, Art Fish with OECD, Chair Deckard, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. That's an interesting point, and it's worth noting that besides the 10% increase in total full-time permanent workforce, a less substantial requirement, because it's more just a process, is that a company sign a first source hiring agreement locally. In the case of Salem, just by example, SUMCO has worked for years with the employment department, which sits at the center of a network, including the community college and the Workforce Investment Act agency in the area and others, to provide referrals from people that are publicly funded, that are receiving publicly funded job training. They don't have to hire those people. That's why it's not substantial in a sense. It's more just an opening and an avenue. We have administratively the power to waive that. We never have done it, nor do we generally expect to ever do it in whole. What we do sometimes, however, is issue a waiver when somebody has been late in providing or getting into that first source agreement. It's supposed to happen administratively when they pre-certify, and SUMCO has continually been involved with that, and I don't know if they can give you their experience about it, but I think it generally works well. But it's wholly unrelated to this kind of major 10% requirement, which is the issue, and the only waiver there, as has been noted, is a prospective one before really the investment is done, the exemption can begin by the sponsor, this local city county governments. And right now there is no flexibility after that.
So the first source hiring, 258B-723, that would not be applicable to this.
Another situation which they're fine there. It's not a hard requirement.
Okay.
It's just something they have to have.
And that's through the director's office.
And that we can do. But generally we just do it for timing screw-ups.
Great.
All right.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Mr. Glasscock and Mr. Pascone.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Larry Glasscock. I'm the president of the Salem Economic Development Corporation and also the manager of the Salem Enterprise Zone by virtue of a contract with the city of Salem. My history with Enterprise Zones goes back to the very beginning when they were first discussed in the state of Oregon in the mid-1980s, and actually have been manager of the Salem Enterprise Zone since it was created in about 1989. I also have been associated with SUMCO and its predecessor corporations, Mitsubishi and Siltec, ever since they came to Salem as well. As a matter of fact, some of us remember back in the early 80s, the high-tech sector went into the tank, And companies were having difficulty, as was Siltec at that time in Salem. And it was at that point in time that Mitsubishi felt that they had an interest in acquiring Siltec. Just to make a long story short, Governor Atiyah and the mayor of Salem at that time, Sue Harris, provided Mitsubishi with a letter that the best efforts of the state and the city would be put forth to create an enterprise zone in the city of Salem to assist them in future expansions. So in about 1989, that commitment was fulfilled with the creation of the Salem Enterprise Zone. Sumco now is the largest, even with the reductions, the largest private sector manufacturing company in the city of Salem. It has also the benefit of being the largest single investment ever made in the city of Salem. I certainly understand, having been associated with enterprise zones for a number of years now, the reason for some of the statutes that would prevent abuse of the enterprise zone for the benefit of companies. When the enterprise zone was developed, never did we think we would go through such a serious economic downturn as we have experienced in the last 4 or 5 years. And never did we think that these type of layoffs and closures would be occurring within our economy. So to affect this type of a thing at this time is sort of like kicking someone when they're wounded and down on the ground. And we think that that this appropriate change to the statutes through 858 should be put into effect so that the local jurisdictions do have the options of making the decision. I guess the other thing is I want to mention is that we need to give our businesses, our existing businesses, as well as those on the outside, a positive comment, a positive image that we don't forget our existing businesses and we care about them. So I think that's the message we want to give. We care. So we support 858 and urge its passage. Also, I'm reminded that Sumco did make a payment last year of something close to $290,000, and they are not asking for a refund of that money. So with that, I'll leave it open to any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is John Pascone, and I'm the president of the Albany-Millersburg Economic Development Corporation. I'm also Enterprise Zone Manager for the former Albany Enterprise Zone, and I'm co-manager for the South San Yam Enterprise Zone out of Lebanon. I would encourage you to support this bill and to also broaden the fix so that you might help other companies as well. I might not be as prepared as others because I just found out yesterday that I was going to be here talking to you. In working with a local company in the Albany area to complete their application for exemption for a pre-certification that they completed in the year 2000, we discovered that when you complete your application for exemption, if the company does not meet the pre-certified employment levels, that they are precluded from any enterprise zone exemptions at all. And this company qualified for 5 years of enterprise zone exemption. They qualified for the first 3 years. They got an extended abatement for the extra years 4 and 5. And we find out that because of the economy and 9/11, that their job numbers have dropped, and they can't qualify for the first year. So not only is this company invested $11 million for their project and completed it, but because they don't qualify for the first year exemption, they don't get any. Whereas if a company qualifies in the first year and drops off in a subsequent year, they can pick it up in another year. So it's really punitive that we have a law where these folks, with the best of intentions, invest the money and had every intention of making their job numbers, because of the economy, they're precluded from qualifying for the exemption in the first year, and because of the way the regulations are written, rather than sort of averaging it out over 3 or 5 years, this company loses 5 years of exemption. And they've put the money into their investment, and all of a sudden the regulations give them nothing. I have no problem with you supporting this bill, but I'd like to see you broaden it for extenuating circumstances, and that should go back to the local zone sponsors to be able to see if the company merits those kinds of changes. If a company can't make the first year, why not let them apply for each subsequent year if they did their best efforts and if they made the investment? The whole idea, not only for them, is to make the investment, but also to create jobs. And if through no fault of their own, they can't make the jobs in the first year, they could probably make it up later, and that's what this company plans to do. So that's my pitch. Any questions?
Thank you. Go ahead, Matt.
Which company are you talking about?
Pacific Cast Technologies. They make titanium castings for the airline industry and for aircraft engines. They employ, their pre-certified average was 240 employees. They expected to be at 264 employees. And they started hiring again. They were down to 212, and they're going to be up to 225 by June. So they feel they can make their pre-certified numbers hopefully next year. But this year is the first year of their exemption, and they don't qualify for that. And so they lose the whole spirit and benefit that the enterprise zone would have given them. And it happens at a time when they're in the worst situation to pay those taxes.
Yeah, I'd like to learn more about, maybe if you could stick around afterwards, I'd like to learn more about that company. My understanding is that this Dash-1 amendment, I don't know if you've had a chance to review it.
I saw it. This company only invested $11 million, so if you make it 18 or 20, you're cutting out the small firms and the small communities that may have the same problem. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'd laud the big company's investment, but there are some other folks out there that could use a little help, too.
Yeah, are you, I guess it's Albany, correct?
Yes.
What understanding do you have that this company might make a decision to reduce employment?
They've already cut back. They're already hiring right now. So they've been down to 212, and then by June they hope to be up to 225. So they think, possibly by the end of this year, they'll be up to their pre-certified average.
Absent any action from the state, they're going to be at 230.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, this company invested $11 million hoping for 264 employees. They had some great plans, and with the economy in 9/11, those plans disappeared. But they're still hopeful. They feel that they're about 2 years behind where they originally thought they would be. Mm-hmm. So it's a shame for the local community to encourage them with this enterprise zone, and now they don't qualify the first year. They don't get any of the 5 years, which seems really punitive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment. Giving tax breaks for business incentives, I think, is very tricky because obviously the goal is we want to do it where we really know it's going to lure businesses here or retain businesses, and then it's just not an extra... A giveaway,
right?
And particularly for legislators like us at this panel, it's hard to know where to draw the line. And particularly in this economy where there are so many people who are unemployed, they're still paying their property taxes on their homes, and there's lots of small businesses that are still paying their taxes on their buildings. And so I just express some caution in terms of where to go on this.
Well, I would agree with you. This company will pay the taxes starting this year, but since we encourage them to invest, and if they can bring the numbers up, why not let them apply for it in the second year or the third year?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point, is to encourage their investment. And I agree, we don't need to be giving tax dollars away. We can't afford it in this state. But, you know, we like to encourage investment. It's about the only economic development incentive we have.
Yeah.
And You know, first year, they don't make it. They're out for 5 years. Seems to me to be very punitive.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have a moment afterwards.
Okay.
Thanks. Anyone else? 858. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 858. Open. I'd like to come back to that. We'll give the sponsors a chance to talk to the members of the committee on the bill, but I'd like to get back to that early next week if possible, and we'll get any revenue impact. Should be one. Open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 28, and he's getting a little bit ubiquitous around here. He's got about 20 tax credit bills in our committee. We call him Senator Tax Credit now. Paul, what does this bill do?
Mr. Chair, SJR 28 is a constitutional amendment. It does require a separate 2% surplus kicker calculation for income derived from capital gains, and just as the current kicker, a constitutional kicker calculation, it separates capital gains into personal income and corporate income tax returns. The Department of Administrative Services compare actual revenue with forecasted revenue at the close of the legislative session, and if in either one of these categories, personal or corporate capital gains revenue, exceeds the forecast by 2% or more, the excess is deposited in the education stability account that was created by Measure 19 last September. I've also included for the committee a history of capital gains income over the last 20 years or so, and that probably as well as anything explains the rationale behind the measure is extreme volatility we've seen in capital gains revenue, particularly in the 90s and then in the last couple of years. I think if as this measure goes forward, there are a couple of issues, implementation issues that the committee would want to discuss. One is that we don't have a revenue category of revenue from capital gains. We have income, we have the source, but we would have to assume some tax rate on that source. So it would be a interpolated kind of estimate of what that revenue was. We also do not have particularly good data on corporate capital gains, but that's something that we could work on to improve. Corporate capital gains are much smaller than the capital gains reported on the personal income tax return. So there would have to be a couple of implementation decisions to be made to formally incorporate this into the estimation process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Maybe I missed this, and if I did, I apologize. But in the chart that accompanies this capital gains income annual percentage change, what do you account for a 70% transition from 2002 to 2003?
70, in terms of those annual rates of change?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are not, you know, keep in mind, those are percentage changes from the prior year. So I think the best way, Senator, to look at the totals, and what that's saying is that the 03 capital gains will come back, but they will still be below the 2001 capital gains. See, they're $2.7 billion compared to $2.9 billion. So it's always a percentage change of where you're coming from. And notice that even if that happens, and I agree with you that that's, you know, that's problematic given where what we've seen in the performance of the stock market. But even if that happens, you're still well below where you were 2 years ago and still less than half of where you were in 99.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chair, I mean, the only thing that sticks out to me is that in 2002 is estimated as well. So, you know, you're essentially saying that capital gains income is going to be down $175 million between 2001 and 2003.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that the you know, the 01 level was the 51% drop was what triggered the big drop in the revenue forecast, and that's saying in 2 years later you're still not back to that level. That'd be another way of looking at that. Mm-hmm. But I think, though, Senator, really the point of all of this is the unpredictability of capital gains.
Sure.
Which I think is the point.
I guess my point, Mr. Chair, is the assumption of in the projections and the estimates of growth in capital gains, you know, given all the other bleak news that we've gotten from revenue forecasts, is sort of hard to imagine that they were able to come up with that.
Well, I think, Senator, that where that estimate comes from, and I should also point out that you don't see a formal capital gains estimate in your forecast document, in a big, thick document. There isn't one. It was something that has been done on an informal basis. Really goes back to the mid-90s when I started doing it, just because capital gains became such a big factor. So there is an implied number, and we get that from DAS, and they give it to us when they release their forecast. They give us what their assumptions are about capital gains. So certainly this type of passage of SGR 28 would make that process much more formal.
Okay.
This discussion sets up your bill perfectly, Senator Tax Credit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would be glad to debate the value of my tax credits compared to some of them that already exist on the books, if ever given the opportunity. But Mr. Chairman, today, I'm here to speak on SJR 28. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, District 19. Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence and the committee's indulgence, I'm going to make some reference to another bill so that you make some understanding of how this came together as a package. SJR 28 was drafted to do several things. One, to create a possible additional source of revenue for the Education Stability Fund. That's because I've never looked at the kicker as a revenue source, because it's nothing that could ever be counted on. But I think that if you did have revenues beyond projections for capital gains, that putting them into the Education Stability Fund might be a good future source of potential revenue for that fund. Second, to separate both individual and corporate capital gains from other income sources for purposes of creating more accuracy in our forecasting, leading to a much lower probability that the kicker would actually kick. I actually believe in some of the rationale behind the kicker, to be quite honest. I have never supported using the kicker for current operating revenue. I don't believe it makes sense to use it for current operating revenue. It might make sense in some circumstances to use it for reserve. It might make some sense to use it for capital needs, and it might make clearly some sense to return it to taxpayers. But using it for current operating, I've never supported and never would. In addition to this bill, trying to actually provide a carrot with the stick, in a sense, I drafted SB 813, which provides an incentive to invest and save and a relatively modest reduction in capital gains taxes.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I just wanted to follow. You also drafted what?
SB 813, which is a companion bill to this.
I see, okay.
In recognition that capital gains would no longer be part of the kicker calculation, I phased in a modest reduction of capital gains taxes from 9% to 8% for individuals, and from 6.6 to 5.7 for corporate capital gains. That's about a 12.5% reduction. Mr. Chairman, in regards to capital gains, they're the single most volatile income source in the forecast. They're a major uncertainty for the forecast. The percentage change of capital gains is 10% times more variable than the percentage change in total income. Taking them out of the forecast will actually make our forecast much more stable for that purposes. And if our forecasts are not stable for capital gains, then the money will end up in the stability fund for our schools, which I think is a reasonable use for them. SJR 28 addresses these objectives by establishing separate categories for capital gains versus other income sources. These categories are used for both forecasting and determine whether a kicker kicks, or funds are distributed to the Education Stability Fund. As I said before, excess taxes on capital gains would be distributed to the Education Stability Fund, and the primary purpose of this bill is that by separating capital gains from other incomes, it would make our forecast much more stable and the rationale behind the kicker law much more reasonable. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this bill and also point out to you that although I have commented on both the stick and the carrot, the stick does not need the carrot. SGR 28 could go forward without Senate Bill 813, which is the actual reduction, but 813 could not go forward without SGR 28.
Well done. Thank you. Committee, any thoughts?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, let me dust myself off first. I fell off the turnip truck on the way here to the Capitol today, and I want to make sure I understand this. Zero of zero, as I said earlier today, is still zero.
Yes.
And if you don't have any economy, you don't have any capital gains. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And to look at these statistics here, that 2003, we're going to grow by 38.4%, 2004, 29.1%. I don't know who's smoking weed here on these numbers, but the economy isn't growing that fast.
Well, we have one that is.
You're smoking weed. Okay, who else?
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment.
It's no longer weed.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment. Obviously, I did not do these calculations, and I think the thing that should be noted in these calculations is that when we were at the height of this is not capital gains taxes, this is capital gains income. When we were at the height of these in 2000, it was $5,963,000,000. We are not projected to get back to that level, even where this chart ends at 2009. In our hopes, we might be back there by 2010. So a decade later, we would be at that same level.
If ever.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, I have actually traditionally broken ranks, and I think Senator Corcoran would testify to this, with most Democrats and have supported reductions in the capital gains tax.
Well,
more than a break.
In respect to my good friend and colleague, Mr. Chairman, 1979, there was 30 members of the Senate, and they created a 2% kicker. There was 6 Republicans and 24 Democrats. 6 Republicans voted no. And 1 Democrat, who was myself, voted no. And it was passed by 23 Democratic votes to do the 2% kicker. I don't know when, and I have never voted for the kicker, and hell will freeze over before I ever vote for the kicker. I don't know why we don't have some truth and honesty in a conversation with the public. You know, what Measure 28 would have generated was equal to the kicker that we gave them the year before, and everybody's throwing up their hands, wringing their hands, saying, oh my God, I can't afford new taxes. And it's the same amount of money that we gave back in the kicker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, I may not disagree with your sentiments. The actual effect of this bill is to make personal income tax forecasts much more stable, which means there's very much reduced chance that the kicker would ever kick. The thing that I thought is always interesting to me about the kicker is that, I'm just going from the forecasting standpoint, is in our dreams we would be able to consistently forecast within 2% for personal income tax, but we might have a chance there. I don't think we will ever be able to forecast corporate income, even if you gave us a 10% kicker, anywhere even close to what the actual income level will be. So the rationale behind tying this to a forecast where you should actually admit from the very beginning, particularly on the corporate side, that you can't do it, has never made sense to me.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Ringo.
Senator Devlin, I think this is a good bill. I agree with Senator Hannon, I'd do away with the kicker. My understanding is the kicker polls pretty high. People want their kicker check, whether they really understand what it does or not. But this would help even out the volatility in the forecast, and to me that makes a lot of sense. That's not to say that I like your carrot, because I don't like your carrot. And I wouldn't look at this as a stick. I think this is doing something for schools, and it helps our government operate better. So I think it's a good bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment also, and I'll close with that, is that one of my other objectives in terms of making those forecasts well, more certain, basically, and more predictable. In addition to that, I am always actually looking for sources. I looked for years to get a real stability fund for K through 12 every session I've been here, and we finally did achieve one, actually, a reasonable one, during the special sessions. And I think part of the language in that legislation, actually, for that stability fund talks about, or at least the discussion on the measure, talks about finding other sources to put into that stability fund so that you create a real stability fund. I fully expect that this body will take the deposits that are going into that fund in this next biennium and use them in this biennium, because it may be the only way to get out of this. So we will be back down to probably about a zero balance in that stability fund by the end of this process.
You know, I think Senator Ringo made a really good point. I agree with the stick part of that. That's actually our function for funding the programs that we choose to function with, the schools, community colleges. That I like this joint resolution. The only, I guess, the biggest question that I would have with it is a joint resolution, which means it goes to the ballot, and this is a pretty complicated question to be putting on the ballot. And I don't know if you thought through.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did not ask probably the specific question that you're probably going to get to legislative counsel, that if the kicker is now in the Constitution, if a modification in terms of determining what income is applicable to it has to be constitutional or could merely be statutory. I did not ask that question.
Mr. Chairman.
I mean,
I have explored that, Richard, and I've been told that it's constitutional.
So it would have to be referred then.
Because if we redefine what we consider to be the income for purposes of the kicker, that is changing the Constitution.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess that's our answer, that it would have to be an SJR or an HJR.
Do you have any thoughts on just, I know this is reading the tea leaves, but voters' receptivity, and this is, you like simple, direct questions, and this one's a little bit. Though I'm intrigued by the whole concept you're driving at here.
I think there would be a way to present it in terms of, I think the public's mood has changed considerably since our previous discussions back in 97 and 99. I think the public, to a large extent, they may not recognize, they may not believe that we're spending every dollar wisely, but they do recognize that we have some real problems in funding programs and in funding some things that they believe are important to them. So I think it could be presented from the standpoint of providing more stability in forecasts, which would help us also in terms of funding programs. And it could be presented, too, in terms of, capital gains are not literally everyday income to the average Oregonian, although many more Oregonians than we realize actually have capital gains. A very large percentage of Oregonians actually have some capital gains to report, that the benefit to schools in terms of portion of, if it does exceed the forecast for capital gains, that going into the stability fund, I think is a selling point with the public.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for your courage and leadership.
Thank you.
You know, Mr. Chair,
I heard part of that. I wanted to get that on the record.
I have a very strong objection. This is almost like legal gambling. I mean, poor Senator Hannon is whining over here after just getting off the
turnip.
That his capital gains on the Celtics are diminished, and I wanted to know if the Celtics were good, how much he lost. I'd like to know how much he lost.
For the record, I think it's important if we heard the first part.
Well, we want to get in the draft.
If it's related to that.
We're done. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Close the public hearing on SJR 28 and adjourn the Senate Revenue Committee.